All right, it's the show. I'm Scott Horton, the Scott Horton Show. Yay. ScottHorton.org is my website. Stop by there to join up the chat room. If you want to join up the chat room during the show. Well, I guess I forgot to log in or promote the show on Facebook or anything today, didn't I? Well, I was reading. Steve Horn busted some activists for being Stratfor plants. I was reading his latest. I always get stuck with the longest, most annoying captions. Are you kidding me? I can't read that. Yeah, that's right. You know, there's a captcha, but it's all you need to do to join up the chat room is put in the captcha at scotthorton.org/chat. You don't need Chatzilla or XChat or Pigeon or any of that stuff. There's a built-in chat room right there at scotthorton.org/chat. Hey, everybody, how the hell are you? Assuming that neither he nor I screwed up the time zone, which I think is possible. Peter Jenkins is going to be back on the show. I told you the other day Peter Jenkins was going to be on the show. Well, that's the deal. Now, Peter Jenkins, he's the former something or other from the UK there. Let's see. Career diplomat for 33 years. And his last assignment, 2001 through 2006, was that of UK ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency and United Nations. There you go. And now he's a regular writer at the Loeb blog, the great Jim Loeb, Washington Bureau Chief of Interpress Service. And his great blog, and all the great company he keeps there. So that should be good. He's got this great piece, nuclear-related sanctions on Iran are no longer justified. Hey, they never were. But okay. This is pretty damn good. So we're going to be talking with him. And then also Jacob Hornberg is going to be here to talk about Syria, to talk about Afghanistan. I'm tired. And to talk about China as well. Oh, Hornberger. That guy, FFF dude, he's been writing a lot of great stuff lately. So he'll be on about that. Speaking of FFF, man, you should take a look at Sheldon Richmond's latest. It's harsh, but it's true. It's called In Afghanistan, They Died for No Good Cause. You know what? I'm sorry. I'm going to go ahead and give this away. He's talking about Richard Engel, the NBC News reporter, is being interviewed by Andrea Mitchell, the wife of Alan Greenspan, the cause of the bubble, which popped. And, you know, NBC News anchor. Can't really call her a journalist. But anyway, so here's what Engel says. Part of the administration's objective in Afghanistan is to protect the legacy of America's longest war. For a lot of the soldiers we've been speaking to, this is personal. They've come here time and time again. They've invested so much. They put their family lives on hold. They've lost friends here. Which, it's amazing, isn't it, how TV news people speak like first grade teachers or something? You could throw in a comma and an and or a but or something somewhere here, guys. This isn't Fox. So the collapse of Afghanistan would be, in a certain way, a personal affront to what they have done. So you have to keep the investment, personal and otherwise, that the U.S. has put in militarily into this conflict. And that's also part of this calculation. To which the show host, the show's ho. To which the show's host, Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Mitchell, replied, "That's probably the most important part of the calculation." Which, of course, they always try to spin all this as mathematics somehow, right? Everything is calculus. Some objective truth that only the high priests of the state can discern. But then Richmond goes on to ask, "Seriously? The most important part of the calculation as to whether the U.S. military will continue to occupy Afghanistan is what American military personnel have lost in the past 12 years, or more appropriately, their feelings about what they have lost? In the business world, that's called throwing good money after bad. In economics, it's known as sunk costs. The past is gone. Any action is future-oriented. The right question is, what would be the consequences of continued military occupation? Additional killing and dying will not bring back the dead or restore lost time, nor will it make the losses worthwhile." You know, Engel and Mitchell, if you assumed a great many of their premises about how legitimate this all is in the first place, and you were to add an additional premise like, everybody knows this war will be done by April if only Obama doesn't ruin everything by snatching victory from the jaws, or defeat from the jaws of victory. But that's not true. Nobody believes that in the whole wide world, not even stupid lying Andrea Mitchell when she's lying to you or herself or the teleprompter she's reading or anything else. It's not going to be fine. There's not going to be a Westphalia-style nation-state loyal to the U.S. with regular democratic elections and guarantees of women's rights in Afghanistan, probably ever. Certainly not anytime soon. And of course, they keep building up the goals and moving the goalposts, and back and forth too. Sometimes they narrow things down to, well, geez, we've got to keep Al-Qaeda out. As though there's a single Arab anywhere to be found in Afghanistan at this point. As though they haven't all been chased to sanctuary in Pakistan. But anyway, that's really the best they got. I wrote a piece like this about George W. Bush back in 2006 called Bush's Sunk Cost Fallacy, where he could not come up with a legitimate purpose for staying in Iraq other than, I already got a bunch of people killed there. And if we call it off now, then that will be the same as admitting that I got them killed for nothing. So, more of them have to die, so that at some point the war can end in a way where it looks a little less shamefully like a complete and total defeat. They left anyway. It's just they were kicked out by the people they helped win more than the people that they were fighting all along. But that's really all they got. And you know what? If you're an American soldier who lost his best friends over there in Afghanistan, especially in some horrible, violent roadside bombing kind of a way, having to understand in 2015 that, geez, so that was it, huh? No more ties to Afghanistan, Taliban rules again, nobody cares, it was all for nothing, would hurt like hell, wouldn't it? I mean, if somehow they were so deluded into thinking that it was anything but a waste at this point. You imagine if you were a father and your son died in the Afghan war, and then it turned out it was all for nothing? You'd probably be really upset. But, you know, the responsibility really lies in great measure with those fathers and sons. With those buddies and friends. If there was a legitimate mission there, it was cut bin Laden's throat or put a bullet in his head. But the Republicans let bin Laden go back in December of 2001. They let him go for 10 years. In fact, Bush even abolished the CIA's bin Laden unit. He didn't want them even looking for bin Laden for 10 years. And they changed the mission to, never mind what Al-Qaeda is, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are the same thing. It's funny because those words don't even rhyme together or anything, but one is just as good as the other. So, who ever heard of bin Laden? We're at war with the Taliban. A war which they've been waging for 10 years, for 12, and which at least since 2005 has been a war ultimately only to make the Taliban more popular and more powerful. And, you know, come on. Everybody knew in 2009 that the surge was a joke. The only exception to that is people who were lying. There wasn't going to be any surge in Afghanistan that was going to make any difference. Remember they went into Marja, this crappy little village, and said, oh yeah, we're going to give you a government in a box. We're going to change your entire society. We're going to use the Delta Force to do KGB-style, Gestapo-style night raids and murder people, and we're going to have the rest of the army stand around like traffic cops, acting as though they care at all about these people and are there to help them. And then what's going to happen is, this was the strategy they sold. What's going to happen is, all of the people of Afghanistan are going to fall in love with the Americans so much that they're all going to come together on the side of the Americans' attempt to change their entire society. That's the Coindonistas direct quote. We're going to change their entire society, and they're going to want it, and they're going to love it. And it's going to work so well that they are going to defeat the Taliban. And that is ridiculous. Of course, Michael Hastings, among many others, showed how ridiculous that was in practice right away. There were many of us who said it was ridiculous before they ever got started. The surge never worked in Iraq, other than to prolong the fighting, really. The Bada Brigade, they were successful. They were going to be successful in their sectarian cleansing of Baghdad, regardless of whether they had extra help from Petraeus or not at that point. Beginning of 07, it was almost already a done deal by then. The only thing that they could say worked about it was they sort of, I guess, helped the majority finish up winning. And then the majority that no longer needed them told them to get bent and get lost. Beat it, North Americans. You bother me. Well, and South American immigrants who, you know, went straight in the army to try to get citizenship. You too. The hell out. So how the hell was that ever supposed to happen in Afghanistan when the whole war is against the Pashtuns on behalf of the Communist Alliance of the 80s? The Hazaras and the Tajiks and the Uzbeks, who are the minority. And it's, what, a 60-40 or 70-30 split there in Afghanistan? And the surge is supposed to help them rule all of Pashtunistan somehow too, huh? Whatever. The whole thing is a joke. And you know what? I mean, that really does suck. I understand where Richard Engel's come from. I guess he's, covered that war. He's actually been there a lot of times, probably met a lot of these soldiers, probably identifies with them in a lot of ways. How would you like to go risk everything to kill people to find out it's all for nothing? Now, a lot of these guys should have known better in the first place. I'm not saying that they don't have responsibility for what they're doing. They could all just go AWOL. They could all just, you know, walk right into the brig and refuse to serve and just do prison time instead. That's what, you know, someone with a real conscience would do. But still, you know, a lot of these guys, they believe all this nonsense about fighting for freedom and, oh yeah, no, we're helping these people, protect them from the bad guys who are trying to keep them from building a wonderful place to live and whatever. And then they get there. They got their buddies dropping dead in pieces, right? It's a little worse than just getting sick and dying in the hospital when you're old or something like that, right? Explosives tear your body apart. And then you got to admit that it's for nothing. That's for nothing. Where at this point, the crew over at NBC, they cannot articulate a single goal this side of absolutely laughable. They can't say, well, you know, we got to make sure there are never any Arabs in Afghanistan again because it's such a great launching point for terrorist attacks against the West. Huh. Really? Afghanistan is, huh? You mean like the Hamburg, Germany cell of Al-Qaeda terrorists from 9/11? Oh. Well, that's pretty laughable. Oh, we're going to keep the Taliban out of power. Nope. The more you fight them, the more powerful they get this whole time. Well, we're going to protect women's rights. Nope. Our sock puppet dictatorship over there just reinstituted the death penalty by stoning for adultery. Oh, well, got to keep Iran out? Hmm. Who really gives a crap if Iran's in there? You know, helping the Tajiks or whoever. I don't care. You care? So all they have to say is, hey, a bunch of Marines gave their lives and body parts for nothing. And if we called off the war now, well, they would know that. And their feelings would be hurt. That's it. That's the MSNBC argument for war in Afghanistan. As Andrea Mitchell put it, it's the most important part of the calculation of whether we have to stay forever or not. Which, of course, you know, implies, too, that as soon as we leave, everything that we've created there, as soon as the empire pulls out of there, the entire edifice of the sock puppet regime that they've created there will fall down. It's just like a green span inflated bubble of power. It's just hot air propping it up. Hot air in the form of your inflationary dollars and military might. But without the U.S., the whole thing will fall apart. There will be nothing there that Andrea Mitchell will be able to point to in 2016 and say, well, the Democrats can brag about their success in Afghanistan. She knows. There won't be a thing to say about Afghanistan in 2016 if the war ends in 2014. But if they can keep it going, then hey, at least it's still going. Right? Just like Lyndon Johnson says in the tapes, I'll be damned if this war is going to be lost on my watch. Maybe the next president will lose it, but it's going to keep on going until I'm out of here. Bush said the same thing about Iraq, even though he signed the deal to leave in 2011 eventually because he had to. The way he put it was, well, no, I mean, my plan is to stay there forever. McCain said 100 years. How about 50? We'll settle for 50 years, like the Korean model, Bush said. And then he said, if anybody's going to decide any different than that, that'll be for later presidents to decide. Not him. He's certainly never going to end that war. That war that, remember, was going to take just a couple of weeks. You see, Saddam is the greatest danger in the world. That's why we got to kill him. Also, he's so weak and pathetic. This will just take a couple of weeks and it'll be free. Don't you remember in, end of March 2003? When the American people were absolutely shocked to find out that the first war appropriations bill was going to be a measly $87 billion. And they all went, what? I thought the war was going to be over by June and it was going to cost nothing. Instead of, you know, $5 trillion and take 8 years and serve only our enemies.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers state that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In the war state, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
All right, you all, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is the show. Hey, listen, I got 600ths of a Bitcoin right now. So if you're one of these fundamentalist, born-again, evangelical Bitcoin types, I know you're out there. You probably will now, I hope, have some sort of obsessive, compulsive need to see to it that I have a lot more Bitcoins than that. That way, I will become even more interested in them and talk about them all the time and become also a born-again, fundamentalist, evangelical Bitcoin supporter. Right? Huh? Am I brainwashing you successfully? That's me manipulating you. Hey, Bitcoin lovers, don't you want everyone to love Bitcoins as much as you? Well, I can help you convince them all, but you're going to have to pay me in Bitcoins. Nah, anyway. I'm always taking donations. People who want to help support this show, go to scotthorton.org/donate, and I certainly will take your Bitcoins. If you want to wait until the next big correction and then give me some Bitcoins, just so you can take even extra pleasure in the fact of watching them grow, while knowing, you know, watching the price rise, while knowing that I'm sitting on a couple that you gave me, then you could do that. The Bitcoin address is right there at scotthorton.org/donate. And the thing is, like I was saying on the show the other day, it's a pretty tremendous increase in the market value of a Bitcoin lately. But then again, they're not just tulips. They have a real purpose. And it seems like the increase in their value on the market was determined, one, by the hearings in Congress, which apparently decided to keep their hands off for now, and also the signing up of the Chinese version of Amazon.com, basically, that they would accept Bitcoins and others. So it's just, you know, out of 7 billion people in the world, whatever, another few percentage points worth have learned about Bitcoins, and the price has gone up. I don't know where the ceiling is. I don't know how low the next correction is going to go, or how low it'll ever go, or what the ultimate number of cheeseburgers per Bitcoin can be bought, you know, on the exchange once the price finally settles down, if it ever does, or what. I can't say. There are people saying a Bitcoin's going to be worth $1 million. Others say 10,000. Others say back down to 50 again. I don't know. But I think they're cool. I think they have a lot of promise. And I think, you know, the more widespread they get, and the more useful they are as an actual currency, the more interest will be gained. And it's a brave new future. I'd like to see a central bank free world, wouldn't you? Who needs central banks? Not me. Not you. Anyway. So, if you want to help support the show, this, that, or the other way, go to scotthorton.org/donate. But obviously, everybody's really excited about the Bitcoin thing. Just because they've gone up so much lately and created a lot of rich people out of people who had simply made a good choice to buy a lot of Bitcoins when they were worth much less each. So, anyway. All right, that's all I got to say about that. Now, so this Hezbollah guy in Lebanon was assassinated, and some say that it was America's Al-Qaeda friends in Syria who did it. There have been some Syrian Al-Qaeda type guy based attacks in Lebanon. It was You know, the war never really has been contained as Syria. So many Iraqis have gone to fight, for example. So they killed this Lebanese Hezbollah military commander. And initial reports were the Israelis must have done it. And then secondary reports were, no, it seems more like the Al-Qaeda guys done it. And then there was this thing that came out of Foreign Policy implying, without outright claiming, that the Israelis had done it and connected his death with the death of a lot of other Shiite leaders in the axis of Iranian influence in the region over the last year or two. And I'm just not sure how credible that was. I like Jason Ditz's interpretation at antiwar.com is, well, yeah, the Israelis claim a lot of things, basically. Here may be something that they're doing. But even the guy at Foreign Policy who is almost speaking with an Israeli government voice, kind of bragging about what awesome assassins they are, adds a word of warning at the end of what is essentially a news report, more than an opinion piece. But at the end, he warns that, you know, blowback from an assassination policy can be really severe. And in fact, we're living it now. Mousawi, the last leader of Hezbollah, was murdered by the Israelis, and he was replaced by Nasrallah, who actually does a lot less goofing off, is a lot smarter, is a lot more effective leader, succeeded, for example, in completely blunting the Israeli assault in July 2006 and driving them right back out of the country, which is something that the Israelis were amazed that he was able to do, that Hezbollah was able to do. But anyway, that just goes to show you what the Israelis' policy is and the way that they look at these things, which is, well, it seems like a good idea today, and I'm not really worried about next week. Whatever blowback happens next week, we'll just kill that then. It's like that time that David Gregory, of all people, asked Leon Panetta if murdering people with drones in Yemen is really a good idea, because all indications are that they just help drive recruitment of Al-Qaeda, that more and more and more people end up signing up to join this international movement against the United States, where before they never had any cause to even consider such a thing. And Panetta's answer was, hey, look, these are the tools we have, and so that's just what we're going to do. And of course, Gregory accepted that as a good enough answer. But that's basically America acting like the Israelis. You know, however ridiculous it is to think that this is beneficial for them in the long term, it makes sense to do it today. Here's a guy we don't like. Let's shoot him. So they do it. And, of course, let the Americans pay for dealing with the consequences later is mostly how they figure, I guess. All right, I got a bunch more news to cover and two great interviews coming up, starting with Peter Jenkins next. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on Liberty Express Radio and scotthorton.org. Full interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And don't forget to join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. All right, our first guest on the show today is Peter Jenkins. He is the former UK ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency and the United Nations. Welcome back to the show, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Well, very good. Very happy to have you here. And I meant to say as well that you've been writing for the Loeb blog. A lot of great pieces at our friend Jim Loeb's blog. That's Loeb, like your earlobe, loeblog.com. This one is called Nuclear-Related Sanctions on Iran Are No Longer Justified. Well, isn't that interesting? Because I thought that the only debate in the whole world was whether we should have a million sanctions on Iran or 1,000,010. And you're saying it's time already, before the final deal, to go ahead and start repealing the sanctions we've already got.
Well, I'm realistic enough to realize there won't be repeal before the final deal. But what I'm trying to do is discourage Congress from bringing in even more sanctions at this stage. Because, as you know, all the debate in Washington at the moment in Congress is about bringing in even more sanctions. It's not, they haven't even begun to talk about lifting them.
And then, now, as far as that goes, is there really a school of thought that says that, hey, now that we're halfway between an interim agreement and a final agreement, now's really the time to tighten the screws in order to really make sure that they go along with what we want? Or is this clearly an act of sabotage?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not the best placed person to answer that. I mean, if you take what these senators and representatives say, if you take them at their word, then they appear to believe that it really would be helpful to bring in more sanctions at this point. That is, to my mind, such an extraordinary idea that perhaps in reality what they're saying does conceal some kind of ulterior purpose, i.e. sabotage.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it seems like, in a way, with the administration taking the pro-talks position and trying to make this deal, they've actually staked out the hardest pro-peace position that's getting any attention at this point, for the most part. And yet, they're almost as bad as the war party when it comes to all of the false assertions about this Iranian nuclear program that they claim to have to go to such lengths to prevent from becoming a nuclear weapon poised to destroy all that is good and true in the world. I mean, it seems like the Democrats have conceded virtually everything that the Republicans and the Israelis have to say about the Iranian threat, and then say, well, but their idea for solving it through these talks is the only way out. And it seems like they're sort of painting themselves into a real corner with that, instead of taking a more honest approach, which is that, come on, they're not really making nukes. All we want to do is be extra sure of that. That's all.
I agree with you 100%. And I would add to what you've just said that they've done themselves a disservice by claiming repeatedly that it's only because of the existing sanctions, and as you know, they're a very, very heavy burden on lots of ordinary, decent, innocent Iranian people, not on the elite who may or may not have had a bit of a nuclear weapons program in the past. But they claim that it's only because of these sanctions that Iran is now ready to talk to us and to do a deal. One of the things I'm saying in my piece is that I don't agree with that. I don't believe that. I know these guys who are leading now in Iran, Rouhani and Zarif, and I'm convinced that for at least 10 years they've wanted to do a deal. In other words, even if the sanctions weren't in place, they would still be wanting to do a deal with us in order to demonstrate to us and to the rest of the world that whatever research they may have done in the past into nuclear weapons, that's a thing of the past, that's over now, and their program is going to be peaceful, and they want to have peaceful relations with the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, a couple of things there. First of all, could you talk a little bit more about the effect of the sanctions on the Iranian people? Because the way that the government and the media talk about it, especially here in the U.S., it's a little bit better in the British papers, I guess, but the way they talk about it is how specific and targeted they are against the worst of the worst, as Cheney might call them, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. These are the men who are being made to suffer under the sanctions, and rightly so. They're the ones who must be pressured into doing what we want, and you seem to be implying that that's not the whole story.
It's 100% bull. Am I allowed to use that word?
Oh, please do. Yes, go ahead, sir.
It's 100% bull, because the initial sanctions, the ones that were brought in a few years back by the United Nations between 2006 and 2010, those were targeted. But since 2010, particularly at the end of 11 and beginning of 12, the US and EU brought in much, much wider-ranging sanctions on Iranian trade and the payments that are associated with trade. And as a result of that, Iran's ability to export and earn foreign exchange has been greatly curtailed, and so has the tax revenue that the government gets from the export of oil. So what you have is a dramatic decline in Iranian foreign exchange and Iranian tax revenues. And since a large part of those tax revenues go on subsidies to ordinary people, to poor Iranians, help them to pay for their fuel, help them to pay for their food, there really has been a big feed through into a decline in the living standards of millions and millions of, as I call them, decent, innocent people. I mean, people just like you and me and the, probably the people who are listening to this show, decent citizens. Mm-hmm.
And then who runs the oil black market out of Iran?
Well, that would be run by the Revolutionary Guard. You're absolutely right. So ironically, those who have profited from these sanctions are the Revolutionary Guards, the very people whom our governments claim the sanctions are targeted. All the smuggling networks in Iran are controlled by the Revolutionary Guards, or at least nearly all. I mean, I shouldn't say all, because I don't know that for a certain fact, but everything I've read suggests that the Revolutionary Guards have a stranglehold on smuggling. Mm-hmm.
Well, they're certainly the most powerful gangsters in the country, no doubt about
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, now, and if you could, please tell us more about your dealings with Rouhani and Zarif from back at your time representing the United Kingdom as ambassador to the IAEA. Would this be, this is the E3 talks?
This is E3 talks, which were launched in October 2003 and which finally collapsed in July 2005. And the reason why they collapsed was that the Iranians made a proposal to us that's actually very similar in many ways to what was agreed in Geneva on the 24th of November of this year, but which we Europeans had to turn down because we didn't want to tolerate any uranium enrichment in Iran, and our American allies didn't want us to tolerate uranium enrichment either. And so one of the most important changes that have happened since the collapse of those talks in 2005 is that the West, the US and its European allies, we've come round to realizing, A, that we don't need to prevent Iran from conducting enrichment, provided that enrichment is geared to Iran's needs for nuclear fuel, and B, that we're not going to succeed in preventing it, because the Iranians just are not going to give way on this point. And even if we were to bomb their enrichment plants, that would only buy us time. And, you know, once the technology exists, once people know how to do these things, then you really can't stop them forever. But I haven't really talked about Rouhani and Zarif, I'm sorry. But what I want to say is that these are very, very impressive guys. They're extremely intelligent. They're very accomplished diplomats. They understand the world. They understand Iran's position in the world, and they're very able to calculate what's good for Iran and what's bad for Iran. And they have long since worked out that trying to get a nuclear bomb It would be a crazy idea, a very bad idea, because Iran doesn't need nuclear weapons. It's not threatened by anyone who has nuclear weapons now that Saddam Hussein is long since dead. And the rest of the world would react in ways that would really harm Iran if it were to try and go all the way to getting a nuclear weapon. So what I'm trying, the message I'm trying to leave with you and your listeners is that these are really smart guys who can work out what's good for Iran and what's bad for Iran, and we need to place a lot of reliance, if you like, on their smartness, because if they don't want nuclear weapons, then we can be confident that Iran is not going to try and get nuclear weapons.
Right. Now, let me ask you this. The part about they were only ever considering it to keep Saddam out, or in case Saddam ever came up with nukes. Did they tell you that themselves?
No. Well, I'll answer that question in two ways. First of all, it occurred to me that this was the case when I learned from the International Atomic Energy Agency that it was around 1984-85 that Iran reached out for the first time to AQ Khan, the Pakistani engineer who stole enrichment technology from the Europeans and then used it to create the Pakistani bomb. Mm-hmm. Because it was in 84-85 that we all of us, I mean, not all of us, but, you know, intelligence communities and officials and so on, began to be aware that Saddam Hussein was putting together centrifuges with a view to producing weapons-grade uranium for weapons. So I inferred, I think, I intuit that it was the news of what Saddam was up to that made the Iranians change course and start looking into what they could do to counter the threat from Saddam Hussein, because up till then, the revolutionary, the Islamic regime in Iran, had always said that it wasn't interested in nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons were contrary to Shia Islam. So that's one thing. Secondly, I have discussed all of this with an Iranian diplomat, asked him whether it would be helpful for me to write about it, and he, in effect, didn't say to me, oh, you're crazy, none of those things happened, it's all in your imagination. He simply, he tacitly, if you like, accepted that what I was surmising had in fact been the case. So I feel reasonably confident that it was Saddam Hussein that prompted Iran during a period that lasted from 84-85 to Saddam's death to flirt with nuclear weapons.
It's interesting because that always sounded right to me, but the only place I've ever heard it before was Seymour Hersh retelling what the CIA believes. In his
well,
book, his article.
I'm not in bad company then, am I?
No, no, not at all.
Good.
So that's confirmation, in a sense, at least what's going on there. And, of course, that would have been after, in 1981, the Israelis bombed Saddam's facilities and drove them underground and turned his civilian IAEA-safeguarded nuclear program into a military secret, not safeguarded weapons program, which
exactly.
was only, they say, was only discovered in 1991, but sounds to me like you're saying you knew about it 6 years before that.
Oh, I think I must be careful what I say. I think it was well known to those whose job it is to find out what's going on.
Not to you at the time, but to them back
not
then.
Not to me. Yeah.
Yep. I understand. Okay, and then now during the talks, I think it's really important to get back to what you say about Rouhani and Zarif, and that what they're telling you, that they really mean this, that they're saying that, no, really, we're not trying to make nukes. It seems to me, just sitting here from Texas and without experience and without having met these people or anything like that, it seems from the outside to me like what's happened here is they said to the Ayatollah something to the effect of, look, we're really not making nukes here. We really are only making electricity. We've got a little bit of extra uranium, enough to be a bargaining chip or what have you, to negotiate. But so let's go ahead and negotiate, and let's give in to Obama's demands to such a degree that he can claim his fears are allayed, and that it's not just verified, but it's additional protocol verified. It's extra verified. And apparently the Supreme Leader said fine. I mean, and in fact, all the headlines for the Christian Science Monitor and other papers reporting out of Iran are saying that Rouhani's making a really big deal out of this and selling it to the people of Iran, that now's our chance to have this big opening with the Americans and everything. Like, they're making a real big deal out of this at home. And so it just seems funny to me to contrast that with the rhetoric on the right, which is that this is all a Munich, and you, Ambassador, and the rest of them are all a bunch of Chamberlains giving in to Hitler here, when all other indications seem to point away from that, is all.
All other indications point away from that. It's nonsense to compare this with Munich. It couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, it seems to me like maybe they're appeasing us, but okay, you know, I guess.
Yes. To some extent, they are appeasing us. To some extent, they're humoring us by saying, okay, we understand you won't just take our word for it, pity, but never mind, we understand that. So here's all the things we're prepared to volunteer in order to help you finally accept that we're not telling lies, we're not trying to deceive you. When we assure you, when we promise you, when we tell you that we don't want nuclear weapons and we don't have a nuclear weapons program.
And now, so how do you feel about the deal as it exists so far and the prospects for the final deal being made? I mean, I guess if it was just the P5 plus one representatives meeting, they could get it worked out. But there's all kinds of internal politics in the United States, in Europe, and of course in Israel and in Iran as well. I almost worry that 6 months is too long of a time to give the war party a chance to sabotage this thing.
Yes, I don't know if you saw a piece I wrote a month or two back in which I argued that really they shouldn't try and do this in two steps. They should try and do it in just one step and negotiate flat out between now and the end of the year in order to effectively get a comprehensive agreement by the end of the year. Anyway, they chose not to take my advice, and I'm not the least bit bitter about that. They probably know best. But what I'm saying is I do agree with you that it's a little bit worrying that there will be several months during which the Israelis and possibly the Saudis, although I don't know if you saw that statement that the Saudi Foreign Ministry put out 9 days ago, it was really quite positive about the initial step. So maybe the Saudis are beginning to change their tune. But anyway, the Netanyahu still hasn't changed his tune. And as you and I and as many of others know, he's able to mobilize extraordinarily widespread support in the United States Congress against the administration of the United States. It's a most extraordinary situation. Anyway, so all these guys, Netanyahu and his U.S. allies, they do have time now to try and undermine what was agreed in Geneva 2 weeks ago and to try and put all sorts of obstacles in the path of concluding the second half of the agreement, what's called the comprehensive solution. However, I think I'm confident that they won't win. I think the U.S. administration and its European allies are determined to persevere, provided they continue to feel that the Iranians are being straight and are equally determined to get an honest agreement. And technically, it's not such a very, very difficult task that lies ahead of them to find ways of ensuring that whatever goes on in Iran on the nuclear side is solely for peaceful purposes and that the inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency are able to have the best possible access to verify that. It's not an impossible task. I think actually what's going to be hardest of all is persuading Congress to ultimately to lift sanctions, because as you know, what we in the West have had to promise in return for all the things that Iran is promising is that we will in due course comprehensively lift all nuclear related sanctions. And God knows how the administration is going to manage to persuade Congress to do that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I keep reading different conflicting accounts about how much authority he has under those different sanctions bills to provide waivers or to refuse to enforce them in certain ways. There was one piece of foreign policy that said Congress can't do anything about it. If the president wants to waive these sanctions, that's all he has to do is want to. But then others are saying that Congress has butted in and has created such constrictive language about under which circumstances he might be able to lift them, including they basically have to abandon their entire regime and become a Jeffersonian democracy, as Flint Leverett put it, before they'll be lifted. So, you know, I don't really know about that. Do you know much about the limits on Obama's authority to actually follow through on his own end of the bargain, the final bargain they're working toward here?
No, like you, I've heard and I've read that the president certainly does have some quite extensive waiver authority, but I think his waivers can only ever have force for 6 months at a time, and that's important because if you're a company that's wondering whether to start trading again with Iran, what you want for the future is certainty and predictability. And so you're going to hesitate to start trading again if all you've got to base yourself on is a presidential waiver that may or may not be renewed in 6 months' time. So, right. So it wouldn't be a satisfactory basis for moving forward to rely solely on presidential waivers. And then, as you say, I'm not at all certain whether the president's waivers are comprehensive or whether there aren't restrictions imposed on his ability to use his waiver authority by a Congress that, of course, doesn't want him to use that waiver authority.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so here's another thing. And I'm a libertarian peacenik here, and my point of view is way outside of the mainstream and the way anybody involved in this thinks, really, but I try to think from the point of view of the American government on this and put myself in their shoes. And it seems like, you know, from their point of view, they should see a lot of possibilities in the future for a renewed relationship with Iran. Maybe not the kind of friendship we used to have where our government owned theirs, but at least, you know, a significant warming up of and end to the Cold War, basically, sort of like our relationship is with China right now, something like that. And I wonder whether you think that the hard feelings in D.C. over the Revolution of 79 have possibly softened enough that we can really move forward, whether anybody is really looking at it that way or they just are looking at this nuclear deal. Try to put this nuclear issue to bed for a minute, but are they really looking to a brighter future here at all, you think?
Yes, I do. I do think they feel that the nuclear deal is the most essential part of the problem, the Iran problem, because the nuclear deal has the potential to trigger conflict in a very sensitive and economically important part of the world. But I think they will want to move, once they've got a nuclear deal, they'll want to move beyond that to address other questions, such as Afghanistan and Iraq, where the Iranians have said on many occasions that they believe they have common interests with the United States and with Europe and would like to work with us in the interests of stability and peace. Narcotics is another area where we can contribute. And I also think that this is Iranian government would be very happy to take part in Syrian peace talks and in wider talks addressed that would have as their goal the reduction of tension in the Middle East between Sunnis and Shia. This tension has grown, in, as you know, to quite dangerous proportions, really, in the last 2.5-3 years.
Right.
The Iranians realize that. They have no interest in stoking it. If the Saudis are prepared to talk and to lower the temperature, then the Iranians will be happy to talk. So I really do think that this nuclear deal has the potential to open the way to something pretty like a transformation of the situation in the Middle East, which would be extremely valuable for the United States and Europe. And then also, let's not forget that Iran is sitting on top of some of the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, and is a nation of 75-80 million people, and therefore also a market of 75-80 million people. So our traders and investors stand to gain a lot from a gradual normalization of relations with Iran.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the most important point. Remember Dick Cheney in 1998 denouncing Bill Clinton for the sanctions on Iran, saying, let's do business, back when he was the CEO of Halliburton. and you know, you mentioned earlier, I think, the biggest buried lead of this whole story, which is the Saudis saying to the Americans, okay, you want to do a nuclear deal? All right, we'll follow your lead on this, which that's huge as far as the Sunni-Shia split and whether this has to turn into a massive war within their shared civilization over there or not. And we'd all like to see not, I hope.
Indeed, indeed.
All right, well, thank you so much for your time on the show today. It's great to talk to you again.
It's been a real pleasure and talking to you, too. You're extremely well-informed.
Well, I'm very interested in peace, and this audience is as well, and we sure appreciate your perspective a lot.
Great.
All right, everybody, that is Peter Jenkins, former UK ambassador to the IAEA and the UN. And we'll be right back with Jacob Hornberger after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Rocky Mountain Miners at rockymountainminers.com. Ever wanted to destroy the Federal Reserve System? Now's your chance. New free market currencies are making our fake government money a thing of the past, and good riddance. If you want to mine new bitcoins and litecoins into circulation, you need a computer set up to crack the codes to the new coins. Get the Prospector from rockymountainminers.com. It's ready to do the work right out of the box. Crack the equations, spend the money. Use promo code Scott Horton Show and save $100. Get all the info and get the Prospector at rockymountainminers.com.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show. Jacob Hornberger's on the line. He's the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Welcome back to the show, Jacob. How are you doing?
Hey, fine. Great to be back, Scott.
Good times. Very glad to have you here. Tell me, what's the Future of Freedom Foundation?
Well, we're a libertarian educational foundation that was founded in 1989, and we, our mission is to present an uncompromising case for the libertarian philosophy, the moral case, the economic case, the philosophical case. And so what we do is we take the burning issues of the day, both in domestic policy and foreign policy, and we integrate libertarian principles to show people that there really is a practical side to libertarianism. It's not just a philosophy. It's a real way that we can achieve a peaceful, prosperous, free society.
Yeah, well, that's very well put. And the thing of it is that you've got such great content because people like fill in the blank write for you?
Yeah, we've got some of the greatest writers in the libertarian movement, and they're people that have captured our way of thinking in an uncompromising manner that you know, we have a certain flavor, and anybody that comes to our website can see that there's just a tone here that just sets us apart. And part of that is just this uncompromising perspective. I like to tell people that reform is just a real bad word for us. We don't like the idea of reforming the welfare state or reforming the drug war or reforming the NSA or the TSA or the military-industrial complex. We want to dismantle these things because we want a free society, and a free society necessarily presupposes the dismantling of the impediments to freedom, which all these apparatuses are. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you have the plumb line, Sheldon Richmond, writing for you there. But even from your minarchist constitutionalist perspective, Jacob, I always am reminded when I talk with you about Murray Rothbard's article, Do You Hate the State?, where he's talking about some other libertarian and saying, I prefer a radical minarchist to a conservative anarchist. So in other words, if you give me a utilitarian argument for why the status quo could be held on to even longer if we had anarchy or some kind of argument like that, what he wants is, fire-breathing rage against injustice. That's what libertarianism is for, is, saving the people from being the victims of aggression. That's what is the bottom line. So even though you don't go quite as far as Sheldon on your conclusions, every time I talk to you, no matter what, on the air or off, it's always 100%, energy and attention directed at the most important things all along in this whole terror war long. On every part of every war and the torture and the lies and the media and the Patriot Act and Guantanamo Bay, and you go out of your way to include our friend Andy Worthington, author of the Guantanamo Files, since he's the best on that issue, and of course Anthony Gregory, who's competing with Sheldon Richmond for the most libertarian person who's ever existed, and the great crusading journalist, the most successful libertarian journalist in history, and for a lot of future history to come as well, our friend James Bovard, and so many others. So, you know, to me, and here's the other thing, too, is you get along with everybody, and you don't play the sectarian game and play to all the splits inside the libertarian movement. You get along with all factions and accentuate what's best and most important from all sides, too. And I just really admire you. I always have. I think that FFF is such an important libertarian institution, such a great embodiment of who we are. You know, like you read these liberal smears of libertarians by the likes of Mark Ames and Michael Lind at Salon.com and this kind of thing. And you think, yeah, right, yeah, Jacob Hornberger, the fascist, whatever, dude. You don't know what you're talking about, obviously. If FFF is what libertarianism is, then what liberals call libertarianism is just, that couldn't be further from the truth, for one thing.
I just think this is one of the most glorious movements in history. I mean, it ranks up there with the movement that brought us freedom of religion and freedom of the press and due process of law and these other great principles. I mean, libertarianism is about liberty, and part of that is confronting what liberty is. And sure, there's debates and divisions within the libertarian movement over, you know, the anarchist position, the minarchist position, but this only reflects a vibrant movement, a dynamic movement where people are discussing, debating, arguing, and so forth. But where we come together is we want a free society, and unlike our fellow American statists, we know we're not free. I mean, I often say that the quote that I think best encapsulates the plight of our fellow Americans who are not yet libertarians is by Johann Goethe, who said, none are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe they are free. And I really believe that captures the plight of the American people. From the first grade in the public schools that their parents were forced to send them to, and to a certain extent, private schools that are licensed by the state, They have been inculcated with this notion that you live in a free country. This is a free enterprise system. We libertarians have broken through that indoctrination, and that's what sets us apart. And so we say, let's examine what should, well, as a minarchist, I say, what should be the role of government in a free society? And I think that's where we come together with the anarchists in terms of most of what the government is doing is illegitimate. You know, the drug war, the welfare state. Imagine coercing people to be charitable. I mean, it even shocks me when I see Christian support in this thing. Killing people on a daily basis? I mean, you know, what kind of society does that and doesn't question it and say, hey, maybe there's something wrong here? And that's what's always attracted me to libertarianism, is this great moral principle that it's wrong to do certain things, and therefore they should be stopped. They shouldn't be gradually phased out. They should be stopped because they're immoral. And so I love this movement. I just think we're doing something really, really grand, and it's exciting that a lot of people are joining up with us, Scott. Oh, and by the way, let me mention that you're one of these great writers that are writing for us now, too. And, you know, Sheldon, he joined the Future of Freedom Foundation full-time about a year ago. He had been editor of the Freeman over at the Foundation for Economic Education for 15 years. And he's brought a whole new stack of hardcore purist writers, and you're one of them, and we're very grateful for that.
Well, thanks. I've been honored to be published in there, and upon reading the printed versions of both articles I've written for the Future Freedom so far, I've learned that, man, I really got to pare it down a little bit next time. No, I'm really happy that I was able to write for the Future Freedom, and I hope to come up with some more articles for you in the future as well. But now, so tell me this. What if somebody, obviously subscribing to the Future of Freedom is a really big deal, and I wish people would do that. That's fff.org/subscribe. But how else might people help support the Future of Freedom?
Well, the only way that we can do the work we do is with donations and financial support that people give us. And our work depends on people's support. Right now, we're involved in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and this is in large part the resources that we use for the coming year. And we've got, you know, exciting plans for the coming year. We've got a great program that we're going to be doing at the International Students for Liberty Conference. You know, they attract about 1,600 students, and we're right now getting together a fantastic program that's going to be devoted to civil liberties and the war on terrorism and the national security state, because we think it's important to raise young people's vision to how important the warfare state is with respect to freedom. And I consider the warfare state a much bigger threat than the welfare state. And most of us as libertarians got into this because of economics. You know, we read Mises and Hayek and Bastiat and Hazlitt and Rand, and this is all great. But, boy, the warfare state where they got the power to assassinate us, cart us away to a jail without due process, torture us, kill us, I mean, that's a much more direct infringement on our lives and our freedom. And so we've got that planned. Sheldon and I have been taking our libertarian angle on the road. We did that last month where we went to 5 college campuses and conversed with students, the Young Americans for Liberty, another group. And then, of course, we've got our FFF Daily, which we consider one of the best daily libertarian publications on the Internet. We got the Future of Freedom. We got the op-ed program, and we got a lot of stuff out there because we believe in the power of ideas and how ideas can transform a society. But that depends on financial support, and a lot of people support us by subscribing to Future of Freedom. But others give us a larger support where, you know, we need that larger support. We need both the smaller support and the larger support, and so we'd be very grateful for that support, and that's what we're doing right now. We got a fundraising letter that's on our website every day, and explaining, you know, this is what we want to do. This is what we're trying to do. We're trying to achieve a free society through the spread of ideas on liberty, and we need your support.
Right on. Yeah, I sure hope people do that. And, you know, really everybody already knows all the great stuff we've been talking all this time about what it is you're doing over there. This is just to remind them to try to get it back to the forefront. But You know, you can't say Jacob Hornberger and Sheldon Richman and Anthony Gregory and James Bovard and these kind of Wendy McElroy and words like that without making people feel all good and warm and know that those are their allies. Those are the people who are fighting for them. And certainly I associate myself with you. I appreciate your associating yourself with me back more than, you know, in supporting this show. And I sure am happy to try to represent what you guys are doing as much as I can. And speaking of which, and I hope at the end maybe we can mention again about how people can donate. But I was hoping also we could talk a little bit about a couple of your latest blog entries, and if we could, especially starting with Syria and the possibility that Obama is switching back from Al-Qaeda back to the Baathists in Syria.
It's incredible, Scott. I mean, sometimes I think I'm living in this bizarro land, you know, where
it's fun in a way, right?
Happen. Huh?
It's fun in a way. It's yeah, a thrill
really
ride,
is.
I guess, you know?
It really is. When I read this article in the New York Times yesterday, I just cracked up. I said, my gosh, here they are. They're preparing the ground for us to switch back to embracing Assad, the dictator of Syria, who, you know, until just recently is a grave threat to national security, and we're going to bomb the country. Now the New York Times comes out with an article saying, well, now U.S. officials are looking at this more carefully, and they're saying the jihadists are spreading throughout the Middle East. Al-Qaeda is still a force to be reckoned with, and it's part of the Syrian revolutionaries, and so we might have to very quietly now realign ourselves with Assad. And I'm sitting there, I'm laughing. I mean, it's like, wow, is this crazy or not? And everybody acts like it's normal. I mean, that's what's so fascinating, you know? But my feeling is they're just preparing the American people. It's like I said in my blog today in Orwell's 1984, where the official enemy kept switching between Eurasia and East Asia. And everybody was supposed to forget every time they switched that there had ever been a switch. And,
right.
And I think that's what's happening here, because remember, Assad was our ally and friend, just like Saddam Hussein was. I mean, you'll recall the famous torture case of Mehar Ayrar, the innocent man from Canada who the CIA renditioned to Syria for the purpose of torture. Well, that means that Syria and the U.S. had a little rendition torture partnership. And then we turned against them. I'm not sure exactly why. And now we're going full circle. It looks like they're going to start re-embracing him and bringing him back into the imperial fold. It's crazy, Scott. Why do Americans put up with this?
It's like Bender the Robot said on Futurama, comedy's a lost art form. Tragedy. Now that's funny. We've been back in the suicide bomber prisoner beheader brigades for 2.5 years now, and the answer, of course, is because that's what Israel wants.
Oh, yeah, that's a major part of foreign policy for the United States. I mean, they always have to check with Israel to see if something, if what they're going to do is permissible or not.
Right. Not that it has to make sense for Israel, right? Like, if you were Israel, would you prefer to have the Baathists or Al-Qaeda on your northern border? You know what I mean? To ask the question is to answer it for a reasonable person, but not when it comes to the foreign policy of either nation.
No, and you know, the thing is that, you know, we can pick out all these things that are debacles in foreign policy, just like we can in domestic policy, the drug war, the welfare, the bailouts, the out-of-control spending. But that's one of the things I find attractive about libertarianism, is that we're trying to raise people's vision to a higher level. So that it's not just a question of, well, should we support Syria or not? Should we get out of Afghanistan or not? Should we invade Iraq or not? Should we give foreign aid to the Egyptian dictators or not? What we're trying to do is raise people's vision to reject this entire concept of foreign interventionism, where you just rein in the federal government, you bring all the troops home, you discharge them into the private sector, you dismantle the entire national security state apparatus that was brought into existence to fight the Cold War, which, of course, is over. And so, you know, all of a sudden now you're thinking at a higher level when you start doing it. You start saying, oh, well, this isn't just a matter of, you know, reforming this particular program or reforming that particular program. We're talking about a wholesale reevaluation of where the state is to take in America. And that's one of the real distinguishing characteristics. I think everybody wants out of Afghanistan now. Well, except for Obama, I guess, and maybe the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But, you know, most people want out of Afghanistan. They're glad to be out of Iraq. They don't want to go to Syria. But that's not good enough because we live in these lives of constant crisis, constant chaos. Look how they're stirring up trouble over there with China now. And that's going to be the new official enemy, I think. Communism, the Cold War all over again against China. This is no way to live, Scott. I mean, look at the Swiss. They don't deal with this because they don't have a government that's butting into business of everybody and acting as the world's policeman. And that's where we got to keep aiming.
Right. All right, hold it right there. We got to take this short break. We'll be right back with Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation. That's fff.org. Look for the big red donate at the top of the page there. We'll be right back.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Jacob Hornberger, the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org. And yes, they sponsor the show, and yes, I interviewed them all hundreds of times before they ever did, too, because, you know, that's kind of how it already was. That's how they came to sponsor the thing. So it's not a conflict of interest. It's an alliance of interest. So we're talking about the greatness of the Future Freedom Foundation and its wonderful stable of writers and why you should support it, and also some of the most important issues, especially concerning American support for the revolution, as it's been called anyway, the civil war, civil warriors in Syria over the last couple of years, now possibly coming to an end because, as Jacob was quoting out of the New York Times there, U.S. officials are now sounding like me and saying, hey, Al-Qaeda guys, why are we backing them? They're our only actual enemies in the world at all. And really, they are Al-Qaeda guys, but they're not really focused on us, as Patrick Coburn was saying on the show the other day. They're focused on killing Shiites. The only thing we could do here possibly is direct their attention toward us. We ought to be backing out of this hornet's nest as quietly but as quickly as possible at this point, right?
Well, yeah, and you know, let's not forget that the reason that Al-Qaeda has focused on the United States is because of what the U.S. government, the national security state, the U.S. military, the CIA, has been doing in the Middle East for a long time, and especially since 9/11. Because as you recall, after 9/11, they lost their official enemy, which was the Cold War, anti-communism, the Soviet Union, and so forth. And then they went into the Middle East, and they started stirring up a bunch of hornet's nests. And then we get the terrorist attacks, not just on 9/11. We got it in 1993 at the World Trade Center, the USS Cole, the embassies in East Africa, and every one of these things. I mean, the Fort Hood, the Detroit, you can go on and on, Boston. They've always said it's because of what the government is doing over there, the U.S. government. And so, you know, it's amazing to me, Scott, after 12 years, that they're still worried about Al-Qaeda. I thought that when they killed Osama bin Laden, that was supposed to be the end of it. And
yeah.
Instead, they always need an official enemy because they want to keep this Cold War-era national security state in existence with its ever-growing budget, where it's causing fear among the populace. And they know that if libertarians were to prevail and we get the empire dismantled, come home from Korea and everywhere else, Europe, that then all of a sudden there's no more anti-American terrorism. Because that's the root of anti-American terrorism, the invasions of Iraq, Afghanistan, and before that, the sanctions in Iraq, which killed hundreds of thousands of children. That if you dismantle that, then all of a sudden you don't have anti-American terrorism anymore, and oh, what do we need this big Cold War era apparatus all about? And so that's what this is all about. It's how can they stir up new official enemies that they can scare the American people with and then say, oh, well, we're here to protect you. And, oh, by the way, we have to surveil your telephone calls and your emails, and we have to have the power to assassinate you and your 16-year-old children like they've done before. And this is just no way to live. And this is why libertarians say that the warfare state is such a great threat to our freedom, our prosperity, our well-being.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just undeniable what you say there. I mean, you look at the jihadis currently fighting in Syria and in Libya and spreading all over. This whole generation came from the Iraq War, just the same way that bin Laden and his generation came from the Afghan War back in the 1980s. So if they had taken the most minimalist approach after September 11th, even taking into account the whole Clinton years and all of that, but if Bush had just played the September 11th card exactly right and sent, you know, say, you know, this is a fantasy, right? But what if he'd done what the American people actually gave him permission to do? Hunt down, send the Delta Force guys, hunt down and kill bin Laden and then stop all the rest of it and not go occupy Mesopotamia for 8 years, spreading fire in all directions. Just think how many fewer jihadis there would be in the world right now. You know what I mean? They've been, when you say shaking up hornet's nests or whatever, there's no way to overstate it, really. They caused a civil war that led to the Shiites taking Baghdad, the first time the Shiites have controlled the Arab capital in 1,000 years. They destabilized every nation in the region. They created 100 more excuses for further intervention in all directions with that thing. And just the very simple how it could have been instead is so obvious, you know?
We said it from the very beginning, is don't invade Afghanistan in retaliation for what happened on 9/11, because you're going to end up killing and maiming many more innocent people than were involved in those attacks. And it's just not worth it to kill all those innocent people just to retaliate against this gang. And, you know, we strongly advocated, you know, going after them the way they went after the attacker on the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center. Right? This was a guy named Ramzi Youssef. And they waited him out about 2 or 3 years. They couldn't find him, but had Interpol and so forth. And they ultimately found the guy in Afghanistan. They go in there, arrest him. They bring him back to the United States. They put him on trial. They convict him. He's now spending a life term in the federal penitentiary. And they didn't have to bomb the country. They didn't kill a bunch of wedding parties and babies and children and wives in the process. And we kept saying, that's the solution. A military solution to this gang was going to redound to the detriment of the United States. And we've been proven right. I mean, Afghanistan's an absolute mess. It's run by a crooked, corrupt dictator who's really no different from any other dictator, except that he's funded by the CIA with bags full of cash that are carried into his office. That's the New York Times reported that. And it's violent. You never see people going on vacation to Afghanistan or even Iraq. You don't see congressmen going on junkets or taking their wives and children to Iraq. They're hell holes. And this is what U.S. interventionism has done. This is the whole testament to the U.S. empire. It's a negative testament. And, yeah, you're right. Imagine what life, how different life would have been if we had not invaded Afghanistan and killed all those people. There wouldn't be this terrorist-producing machine where they kill 5 people and they produce 10 more terrorists because of anger out of it. And we would have been still, Osama bin Laden, even if they wouldn't have caught him, would have been isolated in some house where he couldn't do any more damage. And then we could be reevaluating the whole role of the empire. But my hunch is that they knew exactly what they were doing, Scott. When they invaded Afghanistan, they invaded Iraq, they knew that it was going to be a perpetual terrorist-producing machine that they could then say, oh, well, you have to keep us in existence indefinitely into the future to protect you from this menace that has now replaced communism.
Yep. All right, everybody, that is the kind of libertarianism you get when you support the Future Freedom Foundation. Please support the Future Freedom Foundation. It's fff.org. And just look for the big red donate right there at the top of the page. They got a new and improved website and a stable of the best writers in libertarianism, including, of course, Jacob Hornberger, who writes almost every day there. The latest is, will Oceania, I mean, America, re-embrace Syria? Oh, God. Even, I love that headline. I can't even read it without laughing. Thank you, Jacob. I appreciate your time again on the show and your support.
That's always an honor, Scott. Thank you.
All right, take care. All right, everybody, that is the great Jacob Hornberger. We'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com.
Good times.
It's amazing, isn't it, how quickly current days can become old days? All right. This is the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. Good old Jacob Hornberger, man. I like that guy. Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. Sign up for their morning email. They got great stuff every day. Great writers every day. That story I started the show with about Afghanistan and the sunk costs, that was at the FFF, the great Sheldon Richman, their vice president and editor of their magazine. I should write more articles for that magazine. In fact, I'm going to be visiting the in-laws and not doing radio all week next week. So maybe I'll write an article then. Can't be that hard. All I got to do is hate something and write about why I hate it so much, right? That's easy. I can do that. Jeez, you put it that way, Scott Horton. Why do you ever stop writing things? Good question. All right. So, I was disappointed that our third guest had to reschedule the show for tomorrow to talk about nullifying the NSA. But then again, there's a silver lining, which is that it gives me a chance to complain more myself about things that I want to complain about, instead of just listening to someone else complain and providing you an opportunity to hear someone else complain, you know. But I want to complain because I got my own complaints to talk about. Like, for example, what the hell is going on in Syria? And America's once and no longer in future support for Al-Qaeda there. It's true that the Democrats have acknowledged, since 2012 anyway, that there's really nobody to support in Somalia. The so-called good guy rebels are impossible to really tell from the bad guy rebels, and it's impossible to hand them arms and guns that don't end up in the hands of the bad guy rebels, and the key to the clue to the, what that all means is, or the answer to why that all is because the bad guy rebels are the ones who are willing to die fighting. They're the ones who really mean it. And what makes them bad guys is not that they're prisoner beheaders and suicide bombers. What makes them bad guys to the U.S. government is that prisoner beheaders and suicide bombers and guys who are really willing to die fighting are also just as willing to die fighting us. And as much as they're willing to cut off some Shiite's head just for being a Shiite, that's how willing they're not to take orders from the middle part of North America. And so what do you do with a bunch of jihadis that you can't control? Someone wrote on my Facebook page, I posted a thing about life under Al-Qaeda in Syria. It really sucks. It's a McClatchy story. And he said, yeah, life under the CIA. And I didn't want to get into it on Facebook, but the point is, yeah, he's totally right, of course, that the CIA has been organizing and financing this whole thing all along. It's been a CIA job since 2011. They hijacked the protest movement in Syria as fast as they could, and they turned it into a jihadi war with the Qataris and the Saudis and the Turks and the Jordanians all working together and bringing in weapons from all over the place and money that they took straight out of your paycheck and out of the price of gas that you pumped into your truck that went back into the coffers in Saudi Arabia and were recycled in jihadi transport. And then, and of course, it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq was a big part of, you know, who were organized and armed Sunnis in the area who were ready to fight when the chance arises to take on the Shiite, Alawite, Ba'athist coalition government in Damascus, except the Sunni insurgency of the late Iraq war. And, of course, the most committed among them. So now, rewind a couple years, go back to 2012, and there was Hillary Clinton saying to CBS News, I used to have this clip handy, but then my computer blew up, and I never did get my sound bites back where they belong, did I? You know what? I bet maybe it's in my iTunes. I bet I could find it. It's Hillary, whatever. Anyway, I ain't lying, I promise. You can find it. Google CBS, Hillary Clinton, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Syria, 2012. I think it's March 2012, something like that. And she says, look, I mean, Ayman al-Zawahiri is supporting this rebellion. Hamas is supporting this rebellion. So who do we give arms to? You know, it could be problematic. No, it's not in here. Wrong folder somewhere. Anyway, then it was just a few months later, according to her and her sock puppets talking to the New York Times, she was the leader of the push inside the government to arm the rebels even more. And correct me if you guys read this story differently, but earlier this year, I guess it was very early this year, February 2013, something like that, maybe March. A story came out saying that last fall, then-Secretary Clinton had collaborated with David Petraeus and Leon Panetta, then at Defense and CIA, and that they had proposed, yeah, let's do it. Let's arm the rebels big time over there, and that Obama had told them no. At the time that Hillary put this in the New York Times, it was supposed to make her look good and tough and strong and Obama feckless and weak and whatever as, you know, a step toward her becoming his replacement in another couple of few years here. So, you know, because we like tough, ruthless bloodletting in our women a lot. We want them to lead us to victory. And so anyway, I have to admit that even though Obama has authorized the CIA to do as bad as he's done this whole time, it could have been a lot worse. And I told y'all, although unfortunately I had to skip a lot of radio right around that time for completely unrelated reasons, I did, I believe, say on the air at the time that I was leaning toward the war in Syria wasn't going to happen. Probably mostly because of Gareth Porter's counsel that Look, if he's going to Congress, he's backing out. And also, I read this article in the New York Times where I just happened to believe this one. It sounded right to me that he really screwed up, and it was like a George Bushism when he came up with that red line crap, that he never meant to do that. In fact, if anything, it was the kind of thing that they had talked about, him and his staff, about, well, look, we're not going to draw any red lines or anything. We just want to say that we have different calculus and whatever. And then he ended up sort of kind of blurting out red line, which was not really meant to be an official, Barack doctrine on Syria, but it was interpreted that way. And then so he had a hard time weaseling out of it when whoever was did that chemical attack. But what he did, actually, he didn't have that hard of a time. You know what he did? He went to Congress. But not only did he go to Congress, there's actually even an ABC headline like this. Now, this could have been CBS, too. It was one of the two. You know, I think it was an ABC headline had it. And not just the headline. The story was, but you can find it in the headline, was that Obama asks for conscience vote. So not only was he going to Congress, and not only was he not telling Pelosi and Reid, get me the freaking votes, he was actually up front asking for the kind of vote where you don't go and try hard to get me the votes. Just let the members of Congress vote how they feel like. No pressure. Really? Don't whip them into shape, was the instruction from the president. In other words, get me out of this thing. Hey. And then, lucky for him, in a PR sense, the Russians came in with their idea that let's just compromise and get rid of the chemicals, and that'll be your way out of this thing. And then that way, they didn't have to hold the vote. They didn't even have the votes in the Senate. But anyway, so it's hardly high praise for dear leader or anything like that, but I'm just saying, what a benefit it is to our society. What a wimp he is. What a pathetic coward our president is. I can't call it wisdom, although I think, there are sound reasons for him to make these kinds of decisions. I think mostly it's because he's afraid. And thank God for that. You know what I mean? Just think of what trouble this guy could get in if, for example, he was Hillary and she had won in 08. And if it had been her in there this whole time with only one mission every morning when she got up at 3 a.m. to that bell to go and kill people and prove what a man she is. God help us. Think if it had been John McCain. And I know I always kind of go all the way to the extreme immediately with him, that he would have gotten us into a nuclear war with Russia by now because he's such a retard and a hothead. But you know what? Even short of that, he would have got us hardcore into war in Syria and Iran both. Just no doubt about it. Probably in his first couple of years in power, he would have done that. And just think what a disaster that would be. So I'm kind of thankful. You know, Phil Giraldi at antiwar.com had an article like this too about, something to be thankful for on Thanksgiving. There's kind of two wars that didn't happen, or at least, one war that didn't happen and at least a half a piece that has broken out. That's a lot to be thankful for this year, and it shouldn't be ignored because, if it bleeds, it leads kind of attitudes either. As bad as it is, it could have been a lot worse. And, hell, even the fact they got the interim deal at all, I think, is huge. You know, he's certainly right about that. All right, now, so, man, there's so much more to talk about. I guess here I wanted to mention that there's this piece in McClatchy, because I may never get a chance to mention this damn thing again. There's this piece in McClatchy just basically reminding us that there's a 6,000-page torture report that the staff for the Senate Intelligence Committee did. And that's not an assertion by me that it's whole and complete and perfect in every way. But damn, dude, it's 6,000 pages. Can you imagine what would happen if you let Marcy Wheeler loose on that thing? Oh, my God. It's a 6,000-page torture report. And you know what? Somebody out there has got to know somebody with access to that thing. It's time to upload that to WikiLeaks. Enough of this crap. the people have a right to know the true history of the Bush-era torture program and the Obama-era one, too. I don't know if the committee report goes that far or not. But the people have the right to know. That's it. What the hell is this? Dianne Feinstein gets to decide. Barack Obama gets to decide. No. Calling all 27-year-olds that work in the U.S. Senate. Get your hands on that report. Liberate it. Expose the truth of it to the people of the world. They have the right to know. The torturers have no right whatsoever to keep it a secret. That's just the truth. If God was here, he'd tell you the same thing. You know, I'm pretty sure. Do the right thing. Liberate the damn report. Should it be released or not? In other words, what's keeping decent people from doing the right thing and uploading that damn thing to WikiLeaks? You know what? Pull the battery out of your cell phone, drive down to the local internet cafe with your thumb drive, upload the damn thing to WikiLeaks, take off your disguise, and get away with it. The hell are you waiting for? Leak the torture report. The people have the right to know. It's as simple as that. And you know what? The tortured have the right to have all the evidence of what happened to them exposed to the light, too. And, you know, the possibility, I don't know, a millionth of 1% of a chance that the rule of law would be applied to the Bush regime and its lawyers and its torturers who broke the law in doing all the things they did as detailed in that 6,000-page torture report. Break off the damn report. The people have the right to know. That's it. Wouldn't that be cool if that was what made somebody decide to leak the report? That'd be great. Give it to Assange. He'll publish the whole thing all at once. And then Marcy Wheeler will read it in 45 minutes and then explain everything important in it to all of us. And then human history will be a richer place for having the truth. Isn't that great? It'll be great. Come on. Leak the damn report. Leak it. Okay. Also, not to bury the lead or anything, but I told you since the dang things came out that I told you back when they were just basically, only very, very few people had car phones, you know, installed. You had to carry the briefcase around and stuff. And I already, I don't know where I had ever heard of triangulation when I was a little kid, but I already knew about triangulation. I already said that. That's a tracking device that you're carrying around with you everywhere you go. I guess I grew up on the Outer Limits or something. I don't know what made me such a paranoid at such a young age. But I just always was hip to that idea from the very get-go. Since back when everybody had a Primeco and you had to have an extra battery and all this crap, you know? And, well, they're tracking you and they're saving it all. And so they have maps of where we all are all the time. And you know what? It's a double-edged sword. That's how it is with all technology from handwriting on. That, you know what? You can go on vacation and work at the same time. On one hand, that sucks because it means you have to work while you're on vacation. But on the other hand, it means that you can go on vacation while you have to work. And it also means that the totalitarian police state will know where you are at all times and what you're doing at all times. And that is, you know, its computers will have a record, which just means all they have to do is type in your name and press enter, and it'll pull up your complete everything that they need on you. You know, like Principal Skinner talking about your permanent record to the nth degree you could have never imagined. Things you've done in your past that have implicated you in ways that you would never even know how to explain away, because you don't even know really if that's really right or not. I was where with who? Huh?
don't know. But they know. They think their computer's really sure about what it all means. And we already have the precedents already set, the Rubicon's already crossed, and don't ever let them divert you from this most essential truth coming out of these Snowden revelations, that the NSA has been sharing their catch with the domestic police agencies. It's not a complete system where every sheriff's department is getting the full haul of everything on everyone within their jurisdiction, but coming soon. That's what them fusion centers are about, fusing all these systems together, all these databases together. And this completely lawless spying apparatus being turned domestically against us, part of the excuse the whole time has been, yeah, but it's just the National Security Agency, and they don't have any authority over the people of this country, really. Not a legit U.S. citizen, not a legit U.S. person, unless you're an agent of a foreign power anyway, in which case, screw you. But, you know, for the rest of us, even if they are spying on us, it's only incidental to them protecting us from, I don't know, the Russians or the Islamo-fascist caliphate or whatever it is, supposedly. But no, turns out they've been passing on their information, for starters, to the DEA, who then go on and pass it on to local officials and tell the local officials, hey, you should pull over this guy and you should search him and you should do this and that to him, but come up with an excuse to pull him over. Don't ever let anybody know that we told you that we know anything about him. Just a friendly hint from Carl over at the NSA ratting on Americans office, special liaison, police state branch, whatever. And then so the deputy sheriffs go out there and, you know, crash into somebody and then call it resisting arrest. And then, oh, look what we found in your trunk, boy. You're going to jail. What a mysterious coincidence that we were both at this intersection at the same time. You're going to be paying fees for the rest of your life. It's only the very beginning of that. I mean, I guess it's possible that people can get their act together and try to figure out a way to nip this thing in the bud, but mostly I think what you'd have to do is get yourself a magic time machine and go back to 2008 and support Ron Paul better. Because he was the last hope we had for the Bill of Rights, and he ain't running again. He's 77, 78 now, something like that. And he's great, but he's not a viable presidential candidate. He could have done a good solid 4 years of repealing things and nullifying executive orders and ordering the military to stop killing people and ordering the NSA to stop spying. Oh, he could have done so much. That Freedom Agenda Act of 2007, oh my God. Can you imagine having a president who was hell-bent on that? But you blew it, capiche? You blew it. And so, here we are. I think it's probably too late. I don't know how anybody can nip this NSA thing in the bud, but there it is in the Washington Post. Latest Snowden files, 5 billion cell phone records a day. Oh, no, don't worry, we're just tracking terrorists, you know, and anyone else we're interested in any way. And anyone who knows anyone who knows anyone they know. What, huh? And everybody in North America, too, but that's just an accident because we vacuum up everything that you happen to be in there. But don't worry, we're not looking at your data unless we choose to, in which case we're looking at it. Great. New Snowden coming out all the time. Blockbuster stories like this. And boy, there's the greatest American hero. There's Scott Horton Show Man of the Year, if not Time Magazine's. He sure ought to. I don't know what excuse Time Magazine could possibly have. The only other person who maybe deserves it would be Rouhani for being such a nice guy that it's basically undeniable how harmless and reasonable he is when it comes to the nuclear deal. Just for his tone being so much more acceptable than, you know, former field hand Ahmadinejad with all his resentments. But nah, it's gotta be Ed Snowden, man. And you know what? I'm sorry that I have not done a good enough job of covering each and every one of these revelations. And you know what? The bottom line is, the real mea culpa there is, I don't understand it well enough to repeat it all off the cuff for you and really get it right all the time. And so what I really need to do is go back and double down and maybe even just triple down and just read through all of this stuff again and again and again until I finally, like, really get it through my stupid freaking head what it all means and which parts are most important to accentuate and what have you. Because I admit, I just don't have my head wrapped around it all yet. I mean, it's easy to say, yeah, they're vacuuming up everything, but then that misses all the real points to be made other than just, you know, time to get angry, time to get motivated to figure out how to do something about it. I don't know. I'm not very good at that kind of crap. You gotta figure out for yourself. Also, just real quick, I want to recommend, go to my Facebook page or my blog, Stress, scotthorton.org/stress. And if you want, there's about an hour and a half long thingamajig there, video of Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, at the New America Foundation. And he gives a talk, and then he does a question and answer with Peter Bergen from the New America Foundation. Then he does a question and answer with the audience. Yeah, you don't even necessarily got to watch the whole thing or anything, but it's pretty damn good. And it'll give you a good taste of what that book is about. And again, I admit, and I apologize for not having finished it yet. I sure plan to interview him at length about it once I finally get it out of the way there. But it's a hell of a thing. But it's, you know, it should be. It's a lot of great work in there. Max Blumenthal, the book is Goliath. And again, scotthorton.org/stress if you want to watch that video. And you know, the neocons in the Israel lobby tried to get his speech canceled. Oh, man, you're running around with anti-Semites or whatever. Max Blumenthal is not an anti-Semite. What in the hell? Those neocons, they don't know how foolish they look trying to stop people from talking about what jerks they are. And really, that's not even what his book is about, right? His book is just about the truth that they lie about. But the neocons only have one answer to any dissent against their position, and that is to try to stop anyone from being able to make a different position than theirs. It's weak and pathetic and stupid. It's kind of funny in a way. And it hasn't worked yet, as Blumenthal points out in his speech. They have not convinced a single group to withdraw their invitation for him to speak. So, more flailing from the, at least temporarily again, dying neoconservative movement. And, boy, is this thing off? Uh-oh, I gotta go. They're not gonna report on the Gitmo hunger strike anymore. That way you won't have to worry about that anymore, okay? So don't worry about that anymore. Tomorrow, the 10th Amendment Center on the National Security Agency. Thanks for listening, y'all. See you tomorrow.